Hello, this is Janet Gowan welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And today's guest, I'm smiling already, is somebody I met, 30 seconds ago?
Right.
Sister Roma of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And will you please just start right off? How do people refer to you when they're talking to you? Like, Sister Roma, come over here?
Yeah, I've been doing this. This is my 30th year with the sisters, Janet. Uh-huh. So I have identified so strongly with that name, and that's basically the name that I go by in everyday life.
So when your friends are giving you a holler across the street, what do they say?
Oh, it's Roma.
Oh, it is.
Everybody
calls
me Roma.
Okay.
When I go to Starbucks and they like, you know, you order your coffee and they write your name on the cup, they ask your name, it's Roma.
Well, that's why I was asking. It's not the whole thing. Sister Roma is like a title. Tell me, please, about, first of all, what is the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence?
Well, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are a 38-year-old nonprofit charitable organization. We're activists and fundraisers. And we started on Easter Sunday in 1979. And basically, it was just a bunch of guys who'd gotten together. They had these nuns' habits that they had borrowed from a convent in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
And they borrowed them why?
Well, Sister Vicious Power Hungry Bitch.
We have not had the pleasure yet. Go ahead.
Was one of our founders. Told the nuns that he was producing a production of The Sound of Music, and he needed these habits.
Oh, of course.
So they graciously agreed to let him borrow them, and he failed to return them and moved to San Francisco. So one day...
Are they kicking themselves, or...?
Oh, the nuns? I think they're fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that they were missed. And now, if they knew where they had led, they'd be very happy. But I hope. It's interesting, Janet. Some sisters love us. Many nuns appreciate what we do and think that we're fabulous. And then there are others who don't. But
okay, so start with the ones who do. What is it you do that is fabulous? Who do you help?
Well, the order started basically as just sort of a guerrilla theater. These guys took these nuns' habits and they went out into the Castro one Easter Sunday because they were so tired of the Castro clone look. Everybody at the time sort of looked like the Marlboro Man. Like the gay dress code was leather jacket, plaid shirt, mustache.
Oh, I do remember,
mustache.
I remember what he looked like. He was gorgeous.
Right. Oh, he was gorgeous.
He was like the standard of...
Well, you know, all gay men are gorgeous. But anyway, so so the sisters went out and decided they wanted to shake things up a little bit. So they ran around in these crazy nuns' habits, and they visited a lot of local hot spots in the gay community. They went out to the beach. And the reaction was so overwhelming, they sort of realized that they were onto something because people were just flabbergasted at what they'd seen. So they did that a few more times, and then they decided to actually form a group. So they got together, and they may have smoked a few things and come up with this name, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, and they started the organization. And then shortly after that was 1979. Shortly after that, a couple years, HIV and AIDS started to rear its ugly head, and the LGBT... Q community was ravaged by the disease.
Oh, sure. We all lost friends.
We've all lost friends and loved ones. And on top of that, people were losing their jobs and their homes.
Because they were too sick to work, you mean?
Well, there was that, and there was such a stigma around it. There was such fear around the beginning of that disease.
Yes.
People were afraid to touch one another.
Yes.
They didn't know how it was transmitted. So people were alone and desolate and in desperate need of help. And the sisters, in their infinite wisdom, somehow decided, you know what, this is a disease like any other disease. We're going to face it head on. We're going to use practical care and education to fight it. So the sisters were actually the very first group ever to produce a safer sex pamphlet.
Oh, good.
Outlining ways for the community to avoid the transmission of sexually transmitted disease. And the first group ever to hold a fundraiser for people who were suffering from HIV and AIDS and needed financial help.
Uh-huh. So you gave financial help.
Right,
so
that was
pay for rent and
all the practical care, things like the AIDS Emergency Fund and Project Open Hand. Those were organizations that all sort of evolved out of the HIV AIDS epidemic, and the sisters were right there alongside with those organizations and Cleve Jones and all of the activists. Like, have you seen that new show When We Rise?
No.
On ABC?
No.
It's based on a book by Cleve Jones about his life during that whole thing, and it's during the Harvey Milk era and beyond.
What's it called again?
When We Rise.
I'll look for it.
Yeah, and it's on ABC. It was a miniseries.
So I can get it on demand or
you
something.
Can watch it on demand. Okay. And it's absolutely amazing that ABC would tell our story in such a compassionate and thrilling way. And Rosie O'Donnell's in it, Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh my goodness, how have I not heard of it?
Yeah, it's produced by Dustin Lance Black, who did Milk. And it's really, it's Harvey, it's Cleve Jones' story.
Okay.
And he's still here in San Francisco. He's a friend of mine. He's an amazing activist. But the sisters were right there during that period leading the fight against HIV and AIDS. So that's one of the things that attracted me to the order.
And you said one of the things that attracted you, tell me about you, how you grew up and what made you, what drew you to that?
Well, that's my favorite subject to talk about myself.
Good.
I think
it's going to be mine too.
Excuse me. So I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was raised Catholic. I went to public high school, but I did go to a private Catholic college. I went to Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lovely childhood, and I was very much enjoyed high school. I was class president for all 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
That whole thing. I was a student leader, and I received scholarships, so I decided to go to the...
Wait, are you an only, or you have brothers and sisters?
I'm an only child.
Uh-huh.
I was adopted
uh-huh.
from a Catholic adoption agency, where I guess my very first year, moments on earth, I was cared for by nuns,
uh-huh,
which
sure.
is rather ironic, isn't it?
Not at all. Go ahead.
Right? Well, you know, like we say, everything is connected, right? So, after college, I went, my junior year in college, I came out to San Francisco to visit a friend of mine who had graduated a year earlier who moved out here, and I had never really thought about moving to California. I always knew I wanted to live in a city. I sort of thought maybe Chicago because that was the closest big city in a city that I was familiar
and
with.
The Midwest is gorgeous.
It is gorgeous.
Michigan is gorgeous.
It really is, especially in the spring and the summer and the fall.
Yes.
You know, the winter, I could take it or leave it.
But snow is fun. I mean, people have a life with snow sports.
Oh, people, and, a lot of people do. Yeah, a lot of people enjoy it.
And you have a green there that you do not get in California.
Right.
Okay.
Very true. It was a very nice place to be from. I have to say that Grand Rapids, Michigan, growing up in that area at that time, we didn't lock our doors at night.
Oh, of course
you know,
not.
It was a lovely place to be from, and I feel very fortunate to have grown up there.
Yeah, I grew up, we didn't lock our house doors or our car doors.
No.
Right.
Right. No, it was unheard of. So I came out to San Francisco to visit a friend, and I just was awestruck because Michigan is beautiful, but it's also very flat. The whole part of the country is very flat. So I had never seen such spectacular vistas. And everywhere you looked, if you looked up, it was gorgeous. If you were up and looking out and down, it was the bay and the bridges and the city and the skyline. And I was like, oh, my head was about to explode. And then, as it turned out, it was June. And unbeknownst to me, there was such a thing as gay pride.
Oh.
So I found myself in the middle of gay pride, surrounded by a million other people.
So for you, that's better than good weather.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that the pride...
But wait, so Pride had not been anywhere else at that point.
Probably New York. But in my world, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, there was no such thing. I mean, there wasn't such a thing as a gay bar with a window in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You know, you couldn't. It was very closeted. So, all of a sudden, here I was, surrounded by a million people, and my community for the first time, and the parade marched down the middle of Market Street through the financial district to the steps of City Hall. And I was like, there's so much power and strength and love. I have to live here. Like, I just knew that I had to live here.
What was life here in Michigan? I mean, nobody knew that you were gay there?
Oh, honey.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
I don't think anybody was surprised to learn that I was gay.
And they learned that later.
Well, I think that because my mom and my family was always so supportive, my mother just sort of made me believe, like, whoever I was and how I was okay.
Oh, I'm going to cry. I love her.
Oh, she was amazing. I was her life. And she was mine. It was just the two of us because my father and she separated shortly after I was adopted.
Aww.
And she raised me by herself with the help of my grandparents.
Did you stay in touch with your father?
No.
Oh, okay.
Mm-mm. He tried to come back later, but that's a whole other show. We could do another hour on
that. Well, let's do that.
Yeah,
okay. Some other time, if you want. Okay.
Not my favorite person. Oh, okay. But my mother, on the other hand, just sort of made me feel like I was okay and everything would always be okay. She wasn't great with it at first. She was raised Catholic and she didn't have any experience with gay people or understand anything about what it meant to be gay. So there was a definite period where it was uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. she came around. And
so you told her.
Right. Well, you know, I don't think I really had to tell anybody. I was always a very effeminate, but but happy and gregarious and loving, and I had the support, like I said, of my family and everything. But the first person that I ever told I was gay was my friend DJ, this lovely woman that I went to college with. And
so that's late in life.
Yeah, it was very emotional. I had already been practicing homosexual. You know, in fact, I did a lot of practice on very early, so I became very good at it.
A little bragging. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, saying those words out loud for the first time were very emotional and very hard. And they're harder for some people than others. But I mean, you're like, oh my God, I'm so surprised you're gay, said no one ever. You know, when I told them. So when I decided to move out to San Francisco, my mom gave me her full support and knew that I'd be very happy here. But I just fell in love with it. And so I graduated from college in 1985. And after the summer of that year, I moved to San Francisco.
So what had you studied? What was your goal?
Well, I had a double major. It was the 80s, so I majored in business because that's sort of what you wanted to do then. Everybody was concerned about money. It was, you know.
You have to pay your rent.
You have to pay your rent. And then I was also have always been very intrigued by people and what makes people tick. And I am so such a fan of... I'm in love with people and psychology, so I decided to also major in psychology. So I had a double major, so I have a BSBA, and my senior thesis was theories of homosexuality.
Oh, good for you. So what was your first job?
My first job, before I moved out here, I sent a bunch of letters to some temp agencies and some headhunters to try and have something ready when I got here, and I was placed at Arthur Anderson and Company, which was at the time one of the big six accounting firms. And they hired me full-time, and I was an administrative assistant to partners and managers at the accounting firm. And I did that for many years. I joined the sisters 2 years after I moved to San Francisco. So from 85 to 87, I was basically just living the young gay dream in San Francisco. I had a pretty well-paying job working in the financial district, and I was boozing it up at happy hours and running around the Castro, just having a ball, exploring the city and learning about what it is to be a free young gay man. And there was a lot of AIDS hysteria around that time. There was always this sort of nagging fear in the back of your head, wondering if you were going to be infected, if someone you knew was infected. We did a lot of looking in the mirror and checking for symptoms like white spots on the tongue or any kind of hint that we were sick. But at the same time, we were still also very sexually active, and there wasn't as much of a emphasis on safer sex practices. There just still wasn't a lot of knowledge about HIV and AIDS. But the sisters were leading that fight. Mm-hmm. And when one day after work, I was in happy hour at the Midnight Sun in the Castro with my friends. We were in our power ties. And the Midnight Sun is a video bar with two giant screens on either end. And for the most part, people just sit there and drink and look at the videos and sort of subtly cruise and chat. Well, all of a sudden, in through the front door burst this character who looked like a nun, showgirl, clown. She was flamboyant and beautiful and gregarious and smiling and laughing, and she seemed to know everybody by name. And she walked right up and she said, "Hello, Michael," which is my legal name. And I just looked at her and I said, "Do I know you?" And it was my friend Norman.
Oh.
Who was a bartender. At the time, there was a bar in the Fillmore. He was a bartender there.
In disguise.
Well, it was his sister, Luscious Lashes.
Oh.
And I was like, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "I'm Sister Luscious Lashes, and I'm one of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence," basically. And I had never heard of the organization.
So that was your introduction to
how I found out about the sisters. And I was just like, okay, wow. Like, I just thought she looked fantastic, and it was entertaining and amusing to me. Well, she lured me into the group, and I got to know the other sisters, and that's when I realized that this was a very small group. There was only six of us at the time who were really active here in San Francisco. And they were very passionate and very smart and very bold and brave. And I learned about the early work that they'd done around HIV and AIDS and the way that they continued to fight for the community. And all of a sudden, it's like a light bulb just exploded over my head. And I was like, oh, my God, like, I care about my community and I care about civil rights and I care about fighting for people and raising money. And it was so amazing to me that my life changed in an instant the minute I met the sisters.
And is that what you do full-time now, work for the sisters? Is that a full-time?
Oh, no, it's 100% volunteer, but I do spend a lot of time doing it.
Oh, so, okay. So
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, it consumes my life, and it has for 30 years.
So the sisters have to have day jobs, essentially. I mean, it's not a... Yeah,
right. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So, and I thought, looking back at it now, I think it's really interesting that in 4 years of Catholic college, I really was never inspired to do anything civic-minded or spiritual or... Mm-hmm. for charity or anything like that. But the minute I met the sisters, it changed my life and I became more spiritual mm-hmm. and more compassionate and a fighter for civil rights. It's like, these are my civil rights. I used to sort of be sort of an assimilationist. I thought, well, if we could all just realize that we're all pretty much the same and just everybody could just get along, it'd be fine. But then I was like, you know what? We're not all the same. Don't ever consider me to be like anyone else or yourself. We're all unique people. We have our differences. We have to accept them and embrace them. And we're all entitled to civil rights. I'm not going to ask you for the rights. They're mine already. I'm demanding them.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Letting you know that they are mine already.
Right.
I have a question from before. You said some of the nuns love you and some don't. Will you talk about those two different reactions?
Oh, you mean actual, like, Catholic nuns?
Actual Catholic nuns.
Well, the same thing goes for people in general. It's always been a very tricky, slippery slope to be one of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, because there are some people who immediately, when they hear the name or they see men dressed as nuns, take offense.
Well, because you're impersonating.
Right. Well, they consider us to be mocking nuns.
Ah.
And they think that it's highly sacrilegious, and they just refuse to really get past how we look and what they think we represent, and really learn that we are actually nuns. We minister to our community. We feed the hungry. We are spiritual and passionate and caregivers to the sick in our community. We raise money for our community. Mm-hmm. We educate the community. We're involved in youth and the arts, and we do many things.
So I understand all that, but when the actual nuns who think you're mocking them, not that you have to reply, but is there an answer to that would make them feel comfortable? As in, like, we're borrowing the uniform because you are so effective?
Oh, well, absolutely. There's no doubt that it's a very iconic image.
That's what I'm
it's immediately
yeah.
recognizable, and it strikes people on many levels. The sisters hit people on levels of drag, gender, religion, politics. It's very complicated. And so there are those people who immediately take offense to it, and they refuse to acknowledge of the millions of dollars that we've raised for charity. We're very transparent. Every single penny that we raise basically goes back to the community.
Sure, but that's just aside from the costume. What about the actual nuns who like you?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people who absolutely understand who we are and respect what we do. And I've seen such a change in... After 30 years of doing this, when I first started, there was a lot of people who were like, what are you doing? What are you supposed to be? Is it Halloween? You know, like, they just didn't understand. They weren't that familiar with
the sisters. Well, that's a reasonable question when you
sure.
see somebody dressed up in June.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it was interesting to see over the years how our hard work and has paid off and our as the order has grown, which, by
well,
the way...
how many people do you have now?
Now we have... Over
how many nuns?
60 nuns in San Francisco, but we have orders on 4 continents. We have over 1,000 nuns worldwide, probably.
No.
Yes, they're popping up all over the United States. We're like Starbucks.
Good.
Yeah, there's a nun on every corner.
Oh, you know, you understand. While I'm laughing, I can't talk, so you go. All right, so my question is, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Is it like Starbucks? They have to get, like, a franchise from you, the original, or they're just popping up on their own?
They are. All of the orders are sanctioned through San Francisco.
Oh, they
the
are.
Mother House.
Okay.
Yes.
The Mother House.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So we have trademarks and 501. We have a nonprofit status that we're very protective of. It's a legit
okay, so
organization. We
if
have a
people
board
would
of,
like to donate to help.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have the sisters.org. We take donations online.
Sisters.org?
The sisters.org.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and we have a board of directors, we have a president and officers, we have a meeting every month.
Oh, I understand, if you're a legitimate... So, I have a silly question, I guess. How do you just order nuns' habits if you're not part of the... I mean, anybody can do... Oh, you go to a costume shop.
Well, no, we have a seamstress who creates our habits. Our headpieces are designed after...
I forgot about in-house, of course.
Yeah. We call them nun bun, but it's actually... the professional term is a wimple.
Yes.
It's what we wear in our heads, and it's sort of shaped like Mickey Mouse ears, but they're big, nice, and full and fat, and they're designed after a 14th century lady-in-waiting... habit and nun's habit, sort of a mixture of the both, and then we have a traditional habit that we change from time to time. But when you see all of the sisters together in traditional habit, which doesn't happen as much as it used to, it's a very impressive sight.
So why doesn't it happen as much as it used to?
Well, we've evolved to the point where we welcome everyone. We have members of every race, color, gender, and we're very excited to be all inclusive, and that means that you're going to get a lot of colorful people with very strong opinions and ideas about self-expression. So sisters choose to dress as they feel comfortable. They feel most comfortable. So you'll see a lot of different costumes. But the thing that will indicate that if you're looking at a sister is the traditional white face makeup that we wear.
Oh, I saw pictures of that. I see.
So the vast majority of us around the world adopt the white face and the giant lashes and the very color and theatrical face makeup. And then every order around the world has a headpiece that is adapted to somehow reflect where they're from. Like in San Francisco, we have the traditional nun bun.
Mm-hmm.
But in different countries and different cities, they have, like in Wisconsin, they wear a big triangle on their head and they're called cheese heads because it's Wisconsin cheese.
Uh-huh.
In Motor City, Detroit, they have hubcaps that they wear on their head. You know, Raleigh, North, in Kentucky, they wear the derby, like the derby hats, like the ladies wear to the hats. It's beautiful to see all the different incarnations of the sisters around the world.
And so are there some activities in town, like in San Francisco, where we could just come out and see you all at work, or you're not floating around as a group anymore?
Absolutely. Well, we always work the gates at Folsom Street Fair and Dory Alley, where we raise a lot of money for the community. But our biggest event, hands down, the most iconic San Francisco moment you could ever spend, where you'll see many, many sisters at the same time, is Easter Sunday in Golden Gate Park.
Okay.
Because that is our anniversary. And it restarted in the Castro in Little Collingwood Park. We used to do that. We decided, well, you know, Easter is our anniversary. Let's throw a free party for the community. And we started with children's. We've always had children's Easter, which is what we start with. And then we've evolved. We got a little too big for that when, at our 20th anniversary, we decided we wanted to close down Castro Street to throw a bigger party. And there was an uproar against that. People were petitioning the Board of Supervisors to not allow us to do that because they thought that our organization was very sacrilegious to do that on Easter Sunday in San Francisco.
And that was okay with the Board of Supervisors?
They decided to grant us the street closure. But that made such national news. CNN followed us all up and down Castro Street for a week talking to us about the controversy. And it was covered in major newspapers and national news that the city was trying, you know, there were people trying to block the sisters from having this party. And as a result, our Easter celebration grew to thousands and thousands of people. And we had to move it to Dolores Park, where it was just one of the most anticipated events in San Francisco in our community for years.
And is that where it's going to be this year?
Well, they were remodeling Dolores Park. The part of it was closed down, so we thought, well, let's move to Golden Gate Park.
Oh,
and
so
sure enough, we moved to Golden Gate Park, and the crowd doubled in size. So now we get 10,000 people at Easter.
So you've outgrown Dolores Park.
We've outgrown Dolores Park.
The city must be very much on your side for all the help that you bring to people.
Oh, the city has always been really supportive. That's why we live in a sanctuary city. This is a place where people can still come and be themselves. We embrace diversity. We respect each other's cultures, our differences. And we do our best to make this a welcoming place. And that's why the theme at this year's Easter is sanctuary. So it'll be spectacular. It starts with the children's Easter at 10 o'clock, and we do face painting and an Easter egg hunt, and there's all kinds of candy and goodies and free things for the kids. And then that shuts down, and Easter officially starts at noon, where the adults all come in, and it's such a San Francisco experience. People bring their blankets, their pets, their kids, a camera, things to eat and drink. It's like a giant community picnic in the park. And then at 1 o'clock, we have our Easter bonnet contest, which is always spectacular. And I emcee all of the contests, so this has been one of my favorite things to do for years and years. And the community, just you wouldn't believe the hats that these queens put together.
So they're all handmade. I mean, so they're not like bought at the store.
Oh no! These, I mean, people spend weeks putting these incredible, giant, spectacular bonnets together. Okay. So we have a huge competition.
What
with
day?
That.
What day is that?
It's Easter Sunday, I believe. It's on the 14th.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't. Just a thought, and then I want to get to asking you about love letters.
Okay.
So when you said, you were talking about, you know, I just decided I could just demand that. Those are already my rights. I can demand those rights. And you referred to yourself, I forget what you said, but the truth of the matter is you were always a leader. You said that you were class president for 4 years in high school.
Well, that's true.
So you always apparently have that tendency.
I guess so, huh?
To take charge.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I guess I did. Yeah.
My next question is, do you ever write letters? Do you write love letters? Have you ever?
Okay, this is sort of embarrassing.
Let's have it.
I'm not like a super huge like sycophant or big fan of celebrities or anything like that, but I did write a fan letter, a sort of love letter to Cheryl Ladd.
Oh, how nice.
Who was in Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
I don't know why, but I just was so infatuated with her.
Okay, so I'm so glad you said that, because in my workshops and whole love letter, fan letters, that is a huge genre of love letters.
Mm-hmm.
Of course that's a love letter.
Sure.
And I really encourage those. And I used to say, you know, a love letter is really about somebody else, about the other guy's qualities. And if there's a performer or anybody in public life that you love, you should send it. First of all, it feels good to do it because you get to bathe in the love you feel.
Right.
But also, they need that. They need... Did you hear back?
No.
Okay. So you don't really know if she got it.
I don't know if she got it or not. I don't even remember how I decided where to send it.
Because very often, in my experience, and my own experience, because I've written them also, you do hear back.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite often.
Oh, that's lovely that you did that.
Well, now fast forward to 2017 when we have social media and everybody is connected on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. Right. You can write little 140-character love letters to your favorite celebrity and you probably will hear back.
Yes, but that's great.
Yeah.
For the immediate.
Yeah.
In the urgency. But there is something about getting a letter and holding something in your hand that has felt the touch of the other person's hand.
Mm,
and, of course, handwriting's king. So I have a thought, and you can say yes or no.
Okay.
When you first talked about the convent from whom you borrowed the habits and then disappeared with them, did anybody ever write them a love letter?
I don't think so.
And say, thank you?
I don't know.
We took off with your...
That would be a question for Vish.
But look what we've become and look what we're doing.
Yeah, I don't know. It was 40 years ago.
Still, somebody's still there.
Probably.
Wouldn't that be nice historically to do that?
That's an interesting idea.
Because you guys are obviously a part of charitable history and all kinds of theatrical history.
Right.
And gay pride history. And
for sure.
As much as is found later in your handwriting is going to be so valuable to historians.
That's really interesting.
You know that? Let somebody find these letters in 100 years. My goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other one is your mother still living?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's been gone for almost 10 years.
That doesn't mean you can't write to her.
Oh, I talk to her every day.
Okay, so it'd be nice it would be nice to write to her. And then mail it to yourself or something, just so you have it down in hand. Okay, just a couple of thoughts.
That's such a sweet idea. I have an idea for you.
Because when you look at this, when you're an old man, and see what you wrote, it'll bring back. What's your idea for me?
I think that this needs to be videotaped. You are a gorgeous woman. You are so sharp. You're sitting here in this vibrant yellow sweater, this beautiful turquoise necklace with accent watch and black, chic black pants, and you're beautiful. Why isn't this videotaped?
I don't know. Probably because I just don't know how to do it. But I have often thought and said about my guests, I wish this were a television moment so people could see you.
Right, yeah.
And your expressions and
I'm sure that your listeners, I'm sure they've investigated you and they sort of know what you look like, but they need to see you in person.
Well, you know what? I'm going to think about that because videotaping, maybe I'll figure out how to do it.
It's just the next step.
It's just the next step because I always want that for my guests.
Yeah. You're such a beautiful person.
Sweet.
I'm just so intrigued.
Thank
and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for doing this. When I first heard about you from Barbara Rose Brooker, and I emailed, and then was referred to you, I was just so intrigued, and I'm so glad we met, and now we're friends, and
yes,
we'll be
sure
friends
are.
Forever.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you for doing this, dear.
Yes.
And if you ever write those letters and you care to share them, come back and read them.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is Janet Gallen for now saying goodbye, and we'll talk to you later.